This is the Falcoholic Podcast, the official podcast of the Atlanta Falcons on the SB Nation Podcast Network. I'm David Walker, and I'm joined by my incredible co-host, the Forever Mad Online, Gina Kelly. Gina, how are you?
I am doing great, David. Thanks. How are you?
Fantastic. We are also joined by the editor-in-chief at The Falcoholic and the wind beneath my wings, the one and only Dave Choate. Dave, how you doing?
Did you ever know you're my hero?
We're off to a fantastic start. Our special guest for this podcast is Michael Rothstein. He is the new Atlanta Falcons reporter at ESPN. We're excited to have him. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, although I'm pretty sure that I might have just walked into a Beaches podcast. I'm not really sure. And for like the four people who got that reference, like, congratulations. I'm glad you like 80s movies.
That was a well-placed reference. And I am going to ask our readers to weigh in on whether they heard and understood the Beaches commentary. All right. So with that, we thought it would be good, Michael, to spend a little time with you, have you introduce yourself to Atlanta fans, learn a little bit about your background, get your thoughts about coming in to cover this franchise in the middle of a major transition. So really, you're coming to Atlanta sort of a perfect time, coming in with a new GM, a new head coach. So I'll kick it off. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, Michael, where you're from, your background, and you know what ultimately led to you heading to Atlanta to cover the Falcons?
Yeah, sure. And before I get into that, I just want to very quickly say, because it kind of answers the part of the last part, is that obviously this job became open because of, you know, the death of Vaughn McClure. And right. Vaughn and I knew each other for well before either one of us worked at ESPN for 13 years. We covered Notre Dame at the same time together. And oh, wow. I said it when I took the job, or when I announced that I was taking the job, that like Vaughn is one of the reasons I'm still in the business. And I just hope that I'm able to live up to the legacy that Vaughn left, because I know the tremendous job that Vaughn did covering the Falcons and how respected he was covering the Falcons. And it's, you know, massive shoes to fill. And I just wanted to kind of, for Falcons fans who may, you know, obviously, hopefully all still remember Vaughn, I just wanted them to know immediately, like, you know, I'm coming at this from a very respectful place of like, Vaughn and I are different, but like, I just hope I can report like Vaughn. And that's kind of a mantra that I've had for a long time. But like, when I say Vaughn McClure is the reason I'm still in this business, that's 100% true, because I was thinking about leaving the business when we were both in Indiana. And he told me not, he basically was one of the people that was like trying to encourage me not to. So before any of the fun and interesting stuff, I just wanted to kick off by just saying like of how, you know, much Vaughn meant to me. And for those who may have forgotten or may have not heard or do not know, there is the Vaughn McClure Foundation, which you can donate to, that is offering scholarships in a bunch of different areas up in his native Chicago and at where he Northern Illinois, where he went. So I figured I would mention that. I'm not one who generally will plug stuff, but that's something I would definitely think that Falcons listeners may not know about, but that is something that maybe some of them will be interested in. And hopefully I can send y'all, after the show's over, the link to the page, if you guys want to include it, and that way anyone can donate if
yes.
they want to.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So that said, I grew up in New York. I grew up on Long Island. I grew up walking distance more or less from New York Jets training camp. I grew up in East Meadow, New York, and the Jets had their training camp in Uniondale at Hofstra University, or Hempstead, depending on how specific you want to get. I grew up there. My parents did not let me play football when I was a kid. My knees and back and some other body parts are very thankful for that now, because I'm 5'10" and somewhere between 180, 100, like, it just would not have worked well, especially because like I just didn't have the skill for it. Let's just be honest. So I went to Syracuse and majored in broadcast journalism, wanted to be on TV, wanted to be like every person that goes to Syracuse, the next Bob Costas. And that did not happen. About my sophomore year, I took a TV class. This is a long story. took a TV class. I couldn't do, this was back before like they had the cameras that moved. You had to move to turn to the cameras. And I looked like basically a velociraptor turning from camera one to camera two. So realized this was maybe not the way to go. At the same time, I also started working at the Daily Orange, the school paper. And I found that I really loved writing and loved being able to tell people stories through really sitting down and getting to know them versus a 90-second VOSAT or, you know, a 2-minute package. And I fell in love with writing and I decided I wanted to do that as a career. And at Syracuse at the time, my classmates who were at the Daily Orange at the time, our graduating class was myself, Greg Bishop, who's the lead NFL guy really for Sports Illustrated, and Jeff Passan, who's the lead baseball writer for Yahoo. They're two of my closest friends. And we all graduated from Syracuse the same year working at the DO. 2 years later was a guy named Eli Saslow, who is a Pulitzer Prize winner. So it was a great time to be there. I learned more from, and I can say this because I've said this at classes at Syracuse to maybe the chagrin of some of the professors, I learned more from the DO than I did from any class at Syracuse. My GPA would probably also attest to that. So I graduated. I freelanced everywhere from DC to Boston in hopes of landing a job and just getting paychecks. And it was a time in journalism that you could do that. I did that for a summer, and then I got a job where I moved sight unseen to Victorville, California, which is in the middle of the Mojave Desert. I wanted to move to California. That was not California that I thought I was moving to. Like I said, I moved sight unseen. I flew in. My dad loves to tell the story that I looked to my left, and this makes me sound stupid. So this is just what you're getting at this point in the podcast, that I turned and I thought that I thought there were storm clouds coming in, but they were the mountains, and we drove through them and it was, you know, pitch black and you couldn't really see anything. And there was a sign that said the exit for the town I was living in. And this was like where I was living. So that was my first job. I was there 11 months. Then I moved to Harrisonburg, Virginia, where I worked for 2 years at the Daily News Record. And I was lucky enough to work under a man named Chris Simmons, who unfortunately has passed away, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago now. He was my mentor. He was a mentor to me. He is very much a reason why I am where I am today, because he just taught me so much about the business and just about life. And he did a really good job of finding young journalists and really working with them. So after 2 years there, I moved to Fort Wayne, Indiana, where I covered Notre Dame for 4 years, along with some IndyCar, some NASCAR, high schools, just a whole bunch of everything. And then I got, when the Ann Arbor News folded in 2009, they started a startup, which was called AnnArbor.com, and they asked me to come and cover Michigan, or I applied and I got the job to go and cover Michigan basketball and ended up kind of writing some columns about football. I did that for 2 years, and kind of just being around Notre Dame and Michigan, and I had created this thing called the National College Basketball of the Year poll, Player of the Year poll, which had for like 5 or 6 years gotten the National College Basketball Player of the Year right. And for those who follow college basketball, you know, there's like 4 or 5 different awards. So that along with some other stuff and some news that I had broken, caught the attention of somebody who was hiring for new college team sites for ESPN. And they asked if I would be interested in covering Michigan for them. It was ESPN. It was the place I wanted to work since I was, you know, 9, 10 years old, maybe. And, you know, it's funny. If you go look at my high school yearbook now, every person has wrote like, oh, we're going to see you on NBC Sports one day, like, or ESPN one day. And it's like, you know, I look back at that recently because I had my 20-year high school reunion, oh, I guess like 3 or 4 years ago, and I like flipped through it and how many people said that. And I was like, oh, well, I actually did that. That's kind of shocking. So I got hired by ESPN in 2011, covered Michigan for 2 years, and then they started NFL Nation. And I had asked, I had plans, frankly, I wanted to be a national college basketball writer. That was what I wanted. That was what I wanted for years. It was kind of my dream. And, you know, dreams change and goals change. And I realized that the NFL was something I wanted to try. And ESPN was gracious enough to say, yeah, we'll give you a shot. And they had me stay in Detroit, and I covered the Lions for 8 seasons. I covered I guess technically I covered Dan Campbell. So four head coaches, three general managers.
Oh, wow.
Three owners, two team presidents in 8 years. And one quarterback. I mean, I guess I was at Jared Goff's first or part of Jared Goff's first press conference. So I guess technically two starting, but really one starting quarterback, but a multitude of other people and one Hall of Famer in Calvin Johnson. Mm. And then around January or so, it became clear that they were going to fill the Falcons job. And I kind of said, hey, I don't. Maybe, yeah, let's, you know, I'd be interested in talking about it. I didn't know if I wanted to do it. And I talked to them about it. And then I came down to Atlanta in February. I was there for 4 days, 2 days in, after walking the Beltline, walking actually past the place I am now moving. I was like, yeah, I really want to do this. I'm a New Yorker at heart. The Beltline felt a little bit like the High Line in New York City. Piedmont Park mm-hmm. felt like a smaller version of Central Park. And I was like, I'm sold on this. And luckily my bosses felt the same way. And here I am, although I'm still technically in Michigan for another month or so until I move to Atlanta. Here I am and I'm covering the Falcons and I'm really excited for the opportunity and the challenge and covering a new team and learning and a bunch of new players and kind of bringing these types of stories I tell to the Falcons audience and, you know, in the way that I tell it, you know, the way that I tell them. And it's something I'm really, really excited about. And I've been really energized about and really want to make sure I get it right. Not only for myself, because, you know, my job and all, but to honor Vaughn as well. And to give Falcons fans really the coverage that, you know, at least the coverage, the best coverage I can give them. And that's always been kind of, for me, the goal of all of it is, you know, y'all, the fans that are like, we're the conduit, meaning the media are the conduit from the fans to the team. Now, obviously that's changed a little bit, but I've always kind of stuck with that. Like the questions fans are asking are the ones that I'm going to try and ask, even though if they may seem like tough questions and they're not softballs. Like, I mean, I'm not here to ask softballs. Like I'm asking the questions that people want to know. And, you know, that's kind of, I guess, me in a very elongated story. So thanks for the listeners who are still here. Appreciate it.
Speaking of those listeners, you know, obviously you were in the Detroit market for a while. You know Lions fans really well. You know how they've dealt with everything that's happened to the Detroit Lions. Do you feel ready to engage with Falcons fans? And are your early impressions of the fan base, are we similar to the Lions? Are we even sadder? I don't know. Where are we at?
I mean, okay, so let's start here. Y'all have been to a Super Bowl. Y'all have been to a Super Bowl. Okay. So one thing before I get any further, because I know I say y'all a lot. It's not an act because I'm now moving to the South. I've said y'all for 20 plus years. One of my friends in college said I was the most Southern sounding New Yorker he'd ever met. So the y'all is very real.
You were destined to be down here.
I know. Absolutely. Right? I feel it. But my brother moved from New York to just outside Raleigh. So we're all kind of, you know, moving, I guess, a little bit south. So to your question, I don't know. I mean, the Falcons have been to a Super Bowl. They've had more sustained success than the Lions have had really at any point in the Super Bowl era. So I don't totally see it as a sadder thing. I think the fan bases are similar from what I've seen so far, but that's just 3 weeks, a month in. And right now I think it's a time of hope for Falcons fans. And I think it's a time of hope for Lions fans. So I think it's similar in that regard. But I don't know. It's too early for me to really make a judgment on kind of one fan base to another, because I think every fan base has its idiosyncrasies and its quirks. And almost every fan base thinks that their team is, what are you doing? Why are you making these decisions? Like, I don't care what team you root for. You hear that. And I know that because I have friends from having lived all over the country. I have friends of multiple teams, and I'll listen to them talk about their teams, and they're all everyone's complaining. No one ever says, oh, you know, I really loved every move they made, and I feel great about everything. Like, how often do you really hear that from a fan, right?
Never.
Like, that's the thing. So I would be hesitant to compare fan bases at this point, other than to say, I know the Falcons fan base is very passionate. I know the Lions fan base is very, very passionate, having spent 8 years there. And what I've seen from the Lions, what I saw from the Lions fan base, I think that the franchises, at least kind of in their misery, have been somewhat similar. Obviously, the Lions have never made a Super Bowl, but they've had a ton of interesting things happen to them at ends of games, including yes. against positive. By the way, every Falcons Lions game, and we're due for one this year too, every Falcons Lions game that I have covered, and I covered three of them, have all ended on the last play of the game and all ended in some bizarre fashion.
Yes.
So yeah. So, but that fits yes. these fans. That fits both of these franchises, right? Because I mean, the Lions under Matt Patricia, I asked Matt Patricia the question that led to the infamous greatest fourth quarter, you know, call in Super Bowl history, quote that he gave, because they had lost yet another fourth quarter lead in week one of mm-hmm. last season against the Bears, and they lost a lot of fourth quarter leads. Well, what have the Falcons been known for the last few years? Losing leads. So yeah. like the franchises.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's true, right?
Like, you're not wrong.
No. Yes, absolutely.
That's what it has been for both franchises. So it's interesting in that similarity between the two of what's happened on the field, I think, the last few years. And both of them right now are starting anew with new GMs and new head coaches. The only difference is that the Lions have a new quarterback in Jared Goff, where the Falcons still have Matt Ryan. But, you know, Matt Ryan and Matthew Stafford are they're friends. Their wives are friends. And like, I actually wrote a story about their, I think we used the word bromance because one of like their mutual friends used the word bromance. and I wrote about that back in 17, I think it was 17.
They're in the basketball league together here as well.
They were. I wrote about that. That was my story. Yeah. I talked to the Buffalo receivers coach, Chad Hall, who's the brother-in-law of Matthew Stafford, also played on that team. And yeah, I mean, the Ryans and the Staffords are also very similar in that I get the sense that they're good people and they want to do a lot in the community. I mean, the Staffords did a ton in the community in Detroit, more than people even realize. And just from what I know of Matt Ryan and his wife, I feel like, it feels very similar there. And we'll see what happens with Matt Ryan this year, next year. I think the draft is going to tell us a lot of what the Falcons may see as the future with Matt Ryan. But Matt Ryan and Matthew Stafford, to me, are very similar as well in their careers and their career arcs. Matt Ryan obviously has won a little bit more and I think has had a little bit of a better career than Matthew Stafford. But some of that has to do with, I think, the team around him in the playoffs as well.
Sure.
Absolutely. So I want to kind of pivot and I want to talk about Kyle Pitts. This is the guy that I would like to see the Falcons take it for. And we are in the middle of our community mock draft on SBNation.com and Dave took Trey Lance for the Falcons instead. So yeah, but you recently mocked Pitts to the Falcons. And I guess one of the challenges people have in embracing the idea of Pitts at four is just like, do you really spend a number four overall pick on a tight end? But he's more than just a tight end. He's a really versatile offensive weapon. So do you think that Kyle Pitts would need to be like a Hall of Fame level tight end, like a generational kind of tight end for the Falcons to use a pick that high on him?
And can I jump in here real quick, Michael?
Sure.
I want to pitch the fact that I think one of your most recent articles was about, you wrote about Kyle Pitts. For our readers and our listeners, Michael has actually written about this as well. Very good article that incidentally sold me more on Pitts after I read it. So please go ahead, Gina. Sorry to jump in, but I felt like that was an important point as well.
Yeah, so I don't know if you heard me laughing a little bit in the background. That had nothing to do with Gina. It had everything to do with how we just spent the last 5 minutes or so comparing the Lions and the Falcons. And if you know anything about the history of the Lions, you know that twice in the last 8 years, they've taken a tight end in the top 10, TJ Hawkinson and Eric Ebron. So I've had this conversation before about taking tight ends high. This is not a new conversation for me to be having. I think Kyle Pitts is unique, and he's unique in that, as it was in the story that David alluded to, where I talked with Matt Bowen, one of my ESPN colleagues, and we talked about the fact that you can really line Kyle Pitts up in multiple places, and he's not your true tight end. He's not your true inline tight end like you think of. He's much more of a hybrid receiver tight end. And you know, Matt Bowen made the comp of Plaxico Burress, who's a receiver. And I think that that's kind of maybe how people should view Kyle Pitts is, yeah, he'll be able to block and get in line, you know, a little bit, but you're going to probably see him split out. At least that's how I would use him. And you can kind of use him a little bit all over the place. To me, and I hesitate to make this comparison, and I'm stating that before I make it, but from just a pure physical body type, he's slower, but from a pure physical body type, he reminds me a little bit of Calvin Johnson, just from a height, weight, physicality. You know, Calvin ran a 40 about a tenth faster and is still the best player I've ever seen live in any sport. That I just think that they're like, you like what you see from a traits perspective from Kyle Pitts, and you like what you saw from a production perspective. Now they play a little bit of a different position, obviously, but Calvin was a very, very good blocker as well. And to me, I think that I can easily see the argument for Kyle Pitts in that Julio Jones is getting up there in years. You know, he's not going to be around forever, as much as Falcons fans would probably like him to be that. So if Kyle Pitts is arguably the second best player if they believe he's the second best player in the draft, we don't know what Terry Fontenot and what Arthur Smith believe, obviously, but say he's number two on their board behind Trevor Lawrence. Most people, I think, would agree Trevor Lawrence probably should be number one on every board. Well, if he's number two, if he's your second best player, I think you take him. And it goes back to what we were talking about before with Matt Ryan and kind of the uncertainty there, because, and maybe this is going to hijack a question that's coming down the road, but when you look at Matt Ryan, everyone knows he's going to be the starter in 2021. Now, depending on that contract and whether they were able to trade him or they designate him as a June 1st cut after next season, he might be around in 2022 as well. So if you draft a quarterback this year, the whole purpose of drafting a quarterback is getting that quarterback on the rookie contract, building a team around that quarterback. So those last 2 years, like, that's a big window for you to win, right? Well, if Matt Ryan ends up being your starter in 2021 and 2022, you've now exhausted 3/5 of that rookie window contract on a rookie, and you still don't know if that rookie is the guy. You know, obviously barring injury to Matt Ryan or something like that, but saying Matt Ryan doesn't get injured, and you know, he has shown in throughout his history, like, that generally doesn't happen. Like, where you're waste to me, that's a pick at number four that is a riskier pick to take a quarterback, because you sit him for a year, that's one thing, especially if it's Trey Lance. You sit him, but once you get in that second year, if you're sitting him, like, if you're the Packers and you do that with Jordan Love and Jordan Love's taken in the late 20s, that's one thing, sure. But this is the number four pick. You can get an elite player, whether it's Kyle Pitts, whether it's Sewell from Oregon, whether it's a quarterback, I can't see them taking a Jamar Chase, but whether it's a receiver, like, there's a chance to get an elite player at four, if you stay at four. So I think you should do that. And that's why I think what they do will tell us more about Matt Ryan and their vision of him for the future than anything else what they do. And that's kind of the most interesting thing that I'm curious of seeing. But to kind of circle back to the question of Kyle Pitts, if you're not going to take a quarterback and you're unable to trade down, I think you take Kyle Pitts because it makes a lot of sense if you are the Falcons. Personally, I would look at Sewell, but I'm somebody who believes that you should try to extend your quarterback's career as much as possible. And Sewell will maybe do that more than anybody else because he will block for Matt Ryan and then whoever replaces Matt Ryan and maybe beat your left tackle for a decade or more. And that's invaluable in the NFL. But I don't know if the Falcons would do that either. I don't think that's like the sexy pick, right? So to me, Pitts is the one that it kind of keeps coming back to because I think that he can offer a team a lot. I think whatever team takes him is going to be very happy that they took him. But if you take Kyle Pitts, you also have to understand that if they play him as a even semi-traditional tight end, that's a hard learning curve. And a learning curve that, frankly, will take over a year. So the expectations need to be in check in his rookie year. But I think that that will be doable as well because it's not like he's coming in as the number one option. He's probably coming in as option, three behind Julio and behind Calvin Ridley. So that, to me, I think could give him a chance to get acclimated, which could be better for Kyle Pitts than anything else.
Speaking of the folks who are going to be taking Kyle Pitts or whoever they end up taking, what's your early impression of Terry Fontenot and Arthur Smith in Atlanta? I think fans are generally pretty excited. We don't know these guys well, but we feel like the change is a good one. What's sort of your thought on the job they've done so far, their philosophy, and what you're hoping to see from them?
Well, I mean, let's be honest. I've covered this team for all of 3 weeks. So there's that. I have yet to be in a press conference with them, but
I need an authoritative pick is what I'm
right. Yeah. So I'm going to give you this is the definitive decision, definitive answer. No, I mean, the reality is this, I think they did the best they could with the options they had in free agency because they weren't going to be able to spend, nor frankly, should they have been spenders, because how many times do you see big free agent team spenders end up not doing well in the actual season? Yep. So, I mean, it's you can look and statistically, I think it's like a 50-50 proposition, maybe even a little bit less. So I think they did what they had to do. They got some depth. I covered Daron Harmon last year. I think Daron Harmon is a good safety. He's got good close. I believe his closing speed is still there. It was there at least in the beginning of the year last year. He's got good closing speed. He's very smart, very instinctual, and he'll be a guy who can be a starting safety for you for a year or two. Obviously a 1 year contract, but you know, you see kind of what happens. Eric Harris, he started last year, 2 years ago rather. And I think he's another guy again on a 1 year deal that makes a lot of sense. So you got veterans at the safety spot where if you draft a safety now, you don't have to thrust them into the lineup right away, which I think is a helpful thing and a smart thing. Brandon Copeland's a guy I know pretty well. I've covered again with the Lions, and he's a guy that can play multiple places, is more of a special teams guy. I like what they did on the defensive line, just bringing back guys. And the thing I like the most of what they did, truthfully, is that except for Mike Davis, all these guys are on 1 year contracts. So you're basically saying, listen, we're putting this together for 1 year, and then we're going to see what it looks like after this season. If it goes well, then, you know, you're building on something. If it doesn't go well, well, that's more of a sign to maybe go into more of a fuller rebuilding type of situation. And, you know, at that point, I think with the conversation we were having before about Matt Ryan, conversation that probably could end up having about Julio Jones becomes even more and more relevant, because it'll be clear at that point that they would need to kind of start over and maybe, you know, build around Calvin Ridley, build around Deion Jones, build around Grady Jarrett, some other players that can still be in their primes 2-3 year, you know, 2023, 2024, when you would have a lot of your other players at that point getting up to speed, and you need to fill out a roster, and filling it out with 1 year deals versus giving guys multi-year contracts, which, I mean, the Falcons were not in a position to do from a cap perspective anyway, to me, it was a smart thing. And it showed that Terry Fontenot was going to be very prudent with his decision-making. Arthur Smith, listen, he's a guy that basically every team that had an opening wanted to talk to him. He showed he, in a passing league, he showed he can, that you can still win running the ball, which I think was a very underrated thing in Tennessee. And he did it with a guy in Derrick Henry who was a good back, and he helped turn him into a great back. He helped resurrect Ryan Tannehill's career. Like, the guy can coach. And moreover than anything else, this is a guy that, I mean, everybody knows his backstory, I think, at this point, right? Like, it's not like he wants to do this. This isn't like, I need to do this. I need to hang on and just go where, you know, I need that. I just need it. Like, it's like, no, like, he really wants to do this because he can go do something else. You know, he has that flexibility financially. So that to me is also really interesting. But he's a guy that's looked at as very innovative. I've listened to a lot of his press conferences. I've listened when he's done various interviews. And this athletic story that Jeff Schultz did with him, I thought was incredibly enlightening as far as how he approaches kind of staying unpredictable with the offense. Now, a lot of coaches say that it's very popular and buzzwordy, and really every team gets figured out to some extent. But I liked what I heard from Arthur Smith there. And I'm curious to see more than anything else when it comes to him. This is an offense, like, the Tennessee offense was very much built on the run. Well, the options that he has right now would frankly lend more to being a passing offense. I think everybody agrees with that, right? Like, I mean, right now, right now, Mike Davis is starting running back. And I think Mike Davis can be good in that role, but I don't think he can be Derrick Henry. And Mike Davis has even kind of said, you know, well, I'm not Derrick Henry. So that was paraphrasing, by the way. That was not his actual quote. That was very much paraphrasing. So to me, I look at it and say, well, let's see what Arthur Smith can do with maybe a pass first offense. And I think that running back's a position they'll probably address in the draft, and maybe they address it on day two. And, you know, if you get a guy like Travis Etienne, for instance, like, that guy's or Najee Harris, like, those guys are really good runners. And then maybe you can build on that as well, and then build that vaunted quote unquote balance that every team strives for and no team really ever gets. So I look at it and I'm really curious to see what Arthur Smith does there, but it's still early. I mean, everybody's still in the honeymoon phase here from a general manager and a head coach standpoint, because they're 0-0. They haven't made a draft pick that people can get upset about yet. They haven't even made a big free agent signing that people can get annoyed with yet, because they just didn't have those options. I mean, I think the most that anyone can really, you know, maybe get a little perturbed about was restructuring Matt Ryan. But let's be honest, like, you kind of had to do that. And whether you did it before free agency or before the draft or after the draft to fit rookie contracts, and it was going to happen at some point. So, yeah. You know, right now I think that they've kind of just done what they've been able to do, and that's basically where they are. So that's a long answer for saying I have no real strong opinion on the job they've done because they've just done what they did.
Oh, I love it. Long answers for no opinion. Welcome to the Falcoholic Podcast. This is our brand.
Well, I think that I could fit in well here.
You already fit in perfectly.
Have me back again. If I haven't completely turned off all of your listeners.
Not in the least. But we do have to pay bills. So on that note, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We are back on the Falcoholic Podcast. This is Dave Walker. I'm joined by Gina Kelly, Dave Choate, and Michael Rothstein of ESPN, talking about his transition into Atlanta to cover the Atlanta Falcons. Michael, you had a tweet earlier today, and it caught my eye because, number one, I'm a big fan of PFF, and it just I feel like they give a good sort of checkoff point to you know, verify against what you're seeing with your own eyes. But more importantly, for this season, they have a mock draft simulator. And you had four different options here. I want to talk about one in particular because you sort of took the three that people have been talking about most. The one you just talked about, Kyle Pitts, one with a quarterback and Trey Lance, and the other one with Penei Sewell, the offensive lineman. That fourth option, you had the Falcons trading back with Washington. And I think this is very poignant because Alex Smith, announced his retirement today. So any hope that Washington may have had of you know, trying to lure him back to start one more season for them is gone. Obviously, they've parted with Dwayne Haskins. We've heard of two teams that people think in theory could trade up with the Falcons in the mid rounds. You know, we're sort of excluding Denver from this conversation at this point. One is Washington, and obviously the other one is New England, who incidentally has had a lot of scouts at the pro days for both Justin Fields and Trey Lance. Realistically, though, and I know the draft is always a wild card, but in your mind, trading back for the Falcons, number one, what kind of draft capital do you think the Falcons are going to need to be looking for? And again, knowing that Dan Snyder has made this kind of move in the past. And then number two, is this a move that you think maybe for a new general manager could buy him additional time in a way, because he is buying sort of future draft picks and not necessarily banking on the guy this year? Like you said, that top five pick is sort of a guy that you're really anchoring yourself to. Trading back sort of gets you out of that conundrum for this year. So what are your thoughts on that trading back scenario for the Falcons at this point?
If I were Terry Fontenot, that would be my first and preferred option. Because if you look at the roster, like we talked about earlier with the quarterback situation and what you're going to do with Matt Ryan and what you may or may not be able to do with Matt Ryan, to me, trading back makes the most sense because you need to repair the defense. The defense has a lot more holes, a lot more issues than your offense does right now, but there's no player at number four that makes any sense to draft defensively. Mm-hmm. Just they're not. I mean, I talked to Mel Kiper about this back when I was still covering the Lions, and they're at seven, and we talked about defensive players there because they also need help on defense. And we talked about Micah Parsons, and we talked about some of the corners. And the reality is the elite players in this draft are all offensive players. Like the elite of the elite of the elite. I think there are some very, very talented defensive players in this draft. Caleb Farley, Micah Parsons, J.C. Horn, among them. And I just can't see any of them going at number four. So if you really want to fix the defense and that's what you need to do, then your best interest to me is trading back. If you're not in love with one of the quarterbacks, what's your best interest? Probably trading back, because if you trade back to nine, if Denver decided to trade up, let's just say that, right? You might be able to get a future. You might be able to get a first next year, potentially. You might not get much more than that, potentially, but you might be able to get another first next year. If you trade back further with New England, with Washington, you're either getting maybe young players back, potentially, if they're going to trade that far up, or you're going to get a boatload of capital draft-wise. And right. That, hopefully, if you are the Falcons, would include a first-round pick in 2022 or 2023. And why is that important? Well, it's important because then the Falcons would have two first-round picks in 2022 and or 2023. And in doing so, if you don't take that quarterback this year and all of a sudden things aren't going well and you say, all right, you need a quarterback, well, that gives you the potential capital and ammo to trade up next year to get a quarterback. If there's a quarterback you're in love with, you know, say the Falcons season doesn't go well and they end up picking eight or nine. Let's just say that, right? Or 10. And all right, there's two, three quarterbacks that you like in that draft. Well, if you all of a sudden have the eight or nine pick, you can package that with whatever pick you got from last year for this year for trading back, and then maybe get up to three or get up to two, similar to what San Francisco did this year, to get that quarterback that you believe in right. In the future. And then it goes back even further to that if you still have Matt Ryan on your roster, then you're in that 1 year window, that like Alex Smith, Patrick Mahomes type, you know, Eli Manning, Daniel Jones type window versus a potential 2 year window. So to me, that's why trading back would make the most sense, is if you're not in love with one of the quarterbacks and if you can find a partner, because that's the key to all of this, right? Because right. Every team would love to trade down except for Jacksonville. Every team would love to trade down, but you need a partner to want to trade up and pay that value in order to make it happen. I've had a GM that I once covered basically said, yeah, you need a partner. Like that's how this happens. And to me, I think what happens at three, because I think a lot of people, or really two and three, you know, will determine what type of partners Atlanta might have at number four to make a trade. And also, how far are you willing to go down if you're Terry Fontenot? If you go down at 15 or 19 and you pick up a second this year, another second this year, and you pick up a first next year, I think that was the trade I made with Washington, was first and second this year and like a first and fourth or third next year. And I threw in like a sixth this year or something like that. I don't remember it exactly. That was like 12 hours ago. basically, to me, you do that, you're able to, you can focus more heavily defensively. It's going to be a pick that's not going to cost you as much money. And it's going to really allow you to say, take an edge rusher, take an interior defender, take a linebacker, or take a corner, all of which, or a safety, all of which you need. I know, you know, there's some fans out there that I've heard from today who said, oh, but I think they're pretty set at linebacker. I'm like, yeah, your top end linebackers are really, really good. Like, they are. They're incredibly talented, but there's no depth there. And, you know, at least one is a free agent after the year. And you only have, what, four linebackers at the moment, I think, if I'm remembering correctly. I'm not 100% well-versed, can do this without staring at it, the roster just yet. But, like, with four linebackers on the roster, like, that's not a lot of linebackers. So they need defensive help at every level. And I think you can go and do that. This isn't a great defensive tackle draft. So, you know, you have Grady Jarrett. You're in good spot there. So to me, I think you try and get an edge rusher, maybe a corner, maybe a linebacker. And you try to me, I think you try and trade back and then really focus on defense. And if the offensive player happens to be the best player on the board at that time, like, let's just, for argument's sake, say they trade from 4 to 9, right? And Justin Fields happens to somehow still be there at 9. And you, at that point, you're like, you know what? The value for Justin Fields is really good at 9. And I picked up, you know, an extra first next year and an extra second this year. Like, all right, I'm going to take Justin Fields. Like, that's different to me than at 4. And so to me, that's the play I would make if I am Terry Fontenot and I had that option. We just don't know what those options are going to look like and whether those options are going to exist 10 days from now.
Yeah, it's all easy on paper.
It is. Listen, again, not to go back to the Lions, right? Like, and I really try hard not to compare the franchise I used to cover and the franchise I cover now, but this was a conversation. This was the exact conversation last year at 3. With the Lions, and they ended up staying put and taking Jeff Okuda. But a large segment of the fan base wanted them to take Tua. No one really wanted to take Justin Herbert. And I think that maybe if they had to do it over again, they would want them to take Justin Herbert. But yeah, I mean, that's part of the conversation, is what do you do? And part of the issue, from my understanding, was I don't think that the trade offers were there at 3 last year. And, you know, those are decisions you have to make. And to me, Terry Fontenot has to figure out, well, you know, do I like what I see if I'm offered something at 4? And if I am, I take it, because that's the one luxury that Terry Fontenot and Arthur Smith have right now, is they have the luxury of time. They have the luxury of knowing they have a couple of years, 3 years, 4 years. I mean, Arthur Blank has shown to be a pretty patient owner and let them really kind of figure things out. At least that's how I've viewed it from afar. So I think that that's a value play where maybe you can trade back and understand, like, hey, I don't want to be drafting this high again, but I can always trade up to get to this spot if I need a quarterback in the future.
Now, I'm not going to hold you to this, but, you know,
he will hold you.
Good.
I will. It'll be a blood thing. People are still holding me accountable for preferring Glenn Dorsey in 2008. So,
and for
Glenn Dorsey was a heck of a player.
He was. It should have worked out. But 1 through 4, how does this thing go? Like, just your gut feeling.
Right.
Who's going where? Who's Atlanta ending up with?
Yeah. So, I mean, clearly, you know, Sam Ehlinger or Ian Book are going to go at number 1 overall. And, Trevor Lawrence is going number 1 to Jacksonville, I think. And by the way, I mentioned those two guys because in those 4 mock drafts I did, I drafted Ian Book with 1 and Sam Ehlinger with the other. And I think either one of those would be fine developmental type quarterbacks to have on your roster. I watched a lot of Ian Book over the last couple of years, living up here, having formerly covered Notre Dame, having friends that are Notre Dame fans. Like, I've watched a lot of Ian Book. I think that there's a lot there to like, but that's not what you asked. So one, Trevor Lawrence, two, Zach Wilson. I think that that really seems to be where that's headed. And then there's number three, and I have no idea.
Oh.
I just have such a tough time seeing the Mac Jones stuff being like real, but yeah, the draft always surprises me. So maybe the Mac Jones stuff is real. And if it's Mac Jones, then the Falcons have a lot of choices. I personally, I don't see the Falcons taking Mac Jones at four if Mac Jones is there. I don't see that. That would be a surprise to me. But so what does that leave at four, right? So let's say, all right, let's say that they take Mac Jones at three. Let's just say San Francisco does that, right? They're going to take a quarterback, that much we know.
Mm-hmm.
I think if they cannot trade down, I think they take Kyle Pitts.
Ooh,
I love it.
If they do, if they can't trade, I think they do. But again, understand that is just my pure 100%, 130% opinion. That is not coming with any. Again, I've covered this team for 3 weeks. If I had covered this team for a year, I would feel much better about this conversation and where it was going. I've covered this team for 3 weeks, so understand that anything I am, it's not even like an educated guess more than like just covering the league for how as long as I've covered it and bouncing around and talking to different people type of thing. This is not like I feel this is going to happen or like I feel confident about this. No, I don't feel confident about that decision at all, only because one thing that I've been very impressed with about Terry Fontenot so far is he's kept everything very close. Like, I don't think there's been many leaks or anything like that. I think everything's been very speculative, and that's a credit to Terry Fontenot for being willing to do that. And I think it is what could, at the end of the day, put them in a position where they can get a trade, because they're not telegraphing anything. There are people like a bunch who are talking about Kyle Pitts. There is no one really talking about Sewell, which makes me wonder, by the way, because sometimes it's the guy that no one's talking about.
Exactly.
And then there's a bunch of people talking about Justin Fields to an extent and Trey Lance. So it's like, all right, well, they're doing a good job keeping that interest going. So on draft night, you know, if the board goes how it goes and there's a team that really wants Fields or really wants Lance or, heck, really wants Mac Jones and is like, you know what, I can't risk it getting a six. I can't risk Cincinnati saying, you know what, we want more picks. We're going to trade out of five. I think you may be able to get one or two offers and one you like. And then if you're Terry Fontenot, like I said, if I'm Terry Fontenot, I take the trade down if it's something that I feel is really good value, unless I'm really in love with a quarterback. And they've put a lot of eyeballs on Trey Lance. I think everybody understands that. So they're doing their due diligence as they should. Like, that's the other thing when it comes to, I think y'all have been around for long enough. You know this. Everybody meets with everybody, especially this year when almost everything mm-hmm. is over Zoom. So it's like when you read some, oh, wow, they've met with, well, yeah, everybody meets with everybody. Like, they're, of course, the Falcons are going to meet with every top player possible, because you don't know how this draft is going to go at four. And half the time, like, this is the reality too, is half of those meetings back when we had the top 50 visits, half of those meetings sometimes were, hey, we think team in our division X is going to take player Y, so we want to learn a little bit about him because we might be able to use that down the road. Or, you know, yep. what? I don't know if we're going to get this player here, but 3-4 years from now, this player might be a free agent and you're hoping you're still there. So you have a base. Like, that's what some of those meetings are. And, you know, that's why everything that happens in draft season, I say take with the tiniest grain of salt.
Yeah. These guys are not telegraphing the way that most fans think they're telegraphing.
No, they're not. I mean, if you think that them showing up and watching a guy is telegraphing, I mean, I guess, but like, they're also doing their job. Like, that, like, you can only, Trey Lance has played in one game in 2 years. and you can only have three people at a pro day, which is part of why you're having two pro days. So yeah, guess what? You might have sent a contingent to six if you're the Falcons initially, but you didn't have that option. So of course you're going to do that. You can't have them in for a private workout, which you normally would have done, or gone to campus for a workout. So you need to send more people out there. It's just a different game this year. So I think that so much of like, hey, this person's done this, this person's done that, is not as valid in some ways because of just the lack of being able to scout in person during the regular season, and the lack of being able to bring guys in, really meet with guys, whether it's at the combine, whether it's at pro days, whether it's in private workouts, or top 50 visits that we've seen in years past. And, you know, even going back to last year's draft, like there was at least the in-season scouting and the combine last year. This year, there's none of that. So to me, that's why I think you're seeing so much of this. And that's why, I guess, for me, I've paid attention to it, but I haven't really, nothing's really piqued my interest or like made me think all that much, okay, that might mean something. And maybe it does. And maybe I'm proven wrong in 10 days, but to me, it doesn't. It's just showing a team doing its due diligence. And if I were a Falcons fan, I would see that and I'd say, okay, at least the team is doing the process correctly. And that's, you know, 75% of the time, half the battle.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to switch gears again. Guys, we're switching gears.
Switching gears.
Y'all
need a sound effect for that. Just saying.
We had one for a while.
We did.
We burned it out after 10 episodes.
It was just me saying it in a really aggressive way. So
it was. But I want to circle back. Because we were having, all of us, such a lovely conversation before we started recording, and you know, the fans didn't get to hear that. And I want to go back to Green Lights, Matthew McConaughey's book. And that piqued my interest because two people have recommended that to me. You are one, and Christian McCaffrey is the other. And so
I'll take that company.
Yeah, absolutely. He was super excited about it the last time I interviewed him just a few weeks ago. And so I do have the audiobook downloaded. I am so busy with draft stuff that I haven't really gotten into it yet. So I would love for you to tell listeners and us what we can expect from that one.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I thought you were going to pivot to our mutual celiac problem. I was getting ready for that. But, you know, we can talk Green Lights instead. That's fine. By the way, I think it's also worth mentioning, because it will come up at some point, and I just want to get it out of the way now, because I know it was something that really kind of annoyed some Lions fans. I am not a Falcons fan. I'm getting that out of the way right now. I'm not a fan of any team. I don't love your team. I don't hate your team. My job is to cover your team. And and it's true. And that was something that I know bothered some, and on every beat I've ever covered, bothers some fans. And I just wanted to get that out there right out of the gate, like, so that way there's no questions about that. I'm gonna call it like I see it, and really try and, you know, kind of toe the level and toe the line. That's what I tried to do. Anyway, on to Green Lights. Yeah, I love the book. It was actually recommended to me by another mentor of mine, a guy named Jerry Madelon, who worked at ESPN for a long time and does a lot of consulting around the league right now, with players and coaches. And I was talking with Jerry, I guess it was in December or so, and he recommended this book so highly to me. And I was skeptical because I read a lot. I try to read, I'm actually finally on pace for 50 books a year. Usually I end up reading between somewhere 30 and 43, 44. Those who will end up following me on social media, I will usually post my book list at the end of the year. Last year was a bad year. I only read 18, but you know, COVID, I kind of diverted attention and watched all the Marvel movies and TV series in chronological order instead. But Green Lights. So I just thought it was a really interesting book from a perspective of, I don't think Matthew McConaughey wrote it as like a self-help book or like an inspiration book, but it read like that to me. And there was just stuff in there, and I'm staring at the book right now. It's far, I can't reach for it, but like I dog-eared some pages because I was like, oh, that's really interesting advice, or that's really an interesting way to approach something, or that's just an interesting philosophy. And it just kind of got me thinking as I was reading it about just different approaches that maybe you wouldn't think of, or different approaches that successful people take. And I'm always interested in books like that. And that's really what, to me, Green Lights felt like. Plus, it was funny. I mean, Matthew McConaughey has had a really interesting career arc and a really interesting career. And I thought that some of the choices he made in roles and some of how he got some of the roles he got, including his role in Dazed and Confused, which really launched his career, kind of showed the power of taking a chance, and just kind of showed varying things that I think were applicable, lessons maybe applicable to larger, to more than just acting or more than just Hollywood. And that to me made it something that, I mean, I breezed through it in about 5 days and really, really enjoyed it. And probably, you know, there are probably like a handful of books that maybe I'll reread, that I reread every once in a while. And that might be one of them, because I felt like there was enough in there that, like, if I read it a second time a year from now, I would maybe take other things from it, because I think when you read it, at what point in your life you're in could really change how that book hits you and how that book affects you. It's the rare kind of celebrity type book that I would A, read, and B, that I think made an impact on me. And by the way, I say that having also just finished yesterday Arthur Blank's book, Good Company. And I thought listen, that's my job now. That's like, that was required reading for me. And I learned a lot. It was really interesting to read some of his philosophies. So my dad owned he was high up in a small clothing company when I was growing up. He's since no longer works for the company, semi-retired now. But like, I saw how he ran his business and all of that. So I like reading business type books and decision-making type books, because I think that it kind of helps you in kind of seeing things differently. Like a book that I recommend to a lot of people now was written by Olivier Sibony. It's called You're About to Make a Terrible Mistake. I read it last year, and it's all about, like we were talking about, I think earlier, I don't remember if it was on air or off air, we're talking about biases and confirmation biases. And it's all about the biases you have and how to take them out of your decision-making process and your thought process. And it was an eye-opening book to me. I highly recommend it to anybody, especially fans of teams, frankly, because it's all about decisions, and half of the decisions that you think a team makes are maybe having some bias in it, even if people don't think there are biases in it. So I would recommend that book as well. I actually gave it to a friend of mine who's a manager here in Detroit at a company, and because he had to make a hire, and I was just talking about the book with him and some of my friends, and he was like, "Oh, can I borrow that?" And I was like, "Yeah, here you go." And he was like, you dog-eared like 30 pages in this." I was like, "Yeah, sorry about that." I highlighted and underlined, and I'm usually not that type of person. I'm like a notes person. Like, I have a notebook out, or I have my phone. So I know you asked me about Green Lights, and I hope I gave you some answer there, but I also made at least one other recommendation. I try to, like I said, I'm a big reader. I try to really give good recommendations on that.
And that does lead me to my follow-up question, which is, would you like to join my book club? We meet for brunch to discuss books. Yeah,
sure.
So, great.
I don't know where y'all are. I'm currently, so maybe this is apropos because I'm moving, and I'm moving from a larger apartment to a smaller apartment. So I picked up from the library the Marie Kondo book. And that's next book. Yeah, I'm pretty stoked about that. But after that, yeah, I'm in. I joined one book club this year with a former editor of mine who now works at The Athletic. And then I read the book. I didn't love the book, but I read the book. That was the book. And I then missed the book club meeting, and it was over Zoom, and they like only have it quarterly because it was around the time, I think I had gotten back from Atlanta that day to decide whether I wanted to move there or not, or it was like the day before, and my brain was just done, and I completely spaced out on the book club meeting. I don't know if I'm in that book club anymore. So yes, I'm looking for a book club. I'd love to join your book club.
Okay, perfect. Well, we will go to brunch various places around Atlanta and discuss books there. So I'll keep you posted.
I am all, once I get down to Atlanta, I am all in on that. That sounds excellent. Fantastic.
Michael, we're getting close to an hour, and I want to respect your time. But
we're having fun. We're good. If you guys have more questions, I'm good to rock and roll.
I do want to ask you, I'm going to close this out, but we absolutely have to get you back on the podcast here in the future as well. Any last thoughts for? Because obviously, you know, the Falcoholic readers and listeners are passionate fans of the Falcons and. They're just getting to know you. They, as you mentioned earlier at the very beginning, losing Vaughn McClure, who was just such a fantastic reporter, mm-hmm. who covered the team so well. And I know it was, you know, both Gina and Dave, were close to him as well. What do you hope to bring to the Atlanta Falcons coverage for, those who are looking forward to seeing what, you know, what you have to offer uniquely compared to, you know, some great reporters in Atlanta. You mentioned Jeff Schultz at The Athletic. You know, we've got the one and only D. Orlando Ledbetter from the AJC. So what is it that you hope to bring to Atlanta as you cover the Falcons?
And don't, by the way, don't forget Tori McElhaney from The Athletic.
Oh, she's fantastic.
She does some great work. Yeah.
We're a big fan of hers. Yep.
Yeah. Don't forget her when you're talking about that. I don't know. That's a tough question. I mean, the way I'm trying to think of this is the toughest question you probably asked me. you know, I hope that readers understand that, like, you know, like I said, I'm not a fan. I try to come at things from reporting and from what I'm seeing and using my senses and understanding things in what I write, and that's generally like my football analysis and in my football, in like the reporting I do. I also really like telling human interest stories, because I'm a big believer that at the end of the day, we're all people. They, you know, the Falcons players and coaches and front office staff and owner just happen to be people that you as a Falcons fan care about. And I want to tell you their stories to you. And it may not always be a football related story. And that those are the stories. I think if you go back and look at what I've written about with the Lions, I also cover boxing and some MMA as well for ESPN. If you look at a lot of the boxing stories that I have written that are not off of fights themselves, it's a lot of human interest, a lot of issues that maybe Matt, like taking a player, I'll give you an example. So a couple years ago, I wrote about a player named Armonte Bryant. Armonte Bryant was a guy who bounced around the leaves, seventh round pick of the Browns. He was with the Browns, he was with the Lions, he was with the Raiders. I think he was somewhere else too. And he had been suspended one or two times. And he had to retire from the NFL at, I think it was, I'm going to butcher this, but it was like 27 or 28. And he had to retire because in a test with the Raiders, after he had signed in a physical, it was determined that he had incredibly high potassium levels. And it turned out he was in renal failure and needed to go on dialysis immediately. Gosh. So he had to retire. So I got wind of this. Actually, he had posted it on Instagram, and, you know, Armonte Bryant was not a big name player or anything like that. So I think a lot of people just didn't see it. And I did, and I reached out to I reached out. They like were raising money to try and help get him a kidney. And I just reached out, and his wife called me back, and I missed the call because I was in locker room, and I called back and they didn't call me back. And that was in October. And I kind of reached out a couple other times. I didn't hear back from them. And then I was sitting at home in January, and this was January of 2019. And I was kind of, I don't want to say I was bored, but I was just kind of going through. I have a massive story list that I generally will generate. And I'm actually in the process of it now, of like stories I want to tell, stories that interest me. It always kind of rotates and goes through stuff. And I was just like, you know what? I'm going to try and reach out to them one more time. Let's just see what happens here. I'm curious what's going on here. There hasn't been an update in a while. So I reach out, and his wife calls me back that day. It turns out she's from Long Island. She's actually not from all that far away from where I grew up. And we know some like one or two people she knew that I knew. It's a Long Island thing, even though there's like 15 million people there or whatever. But they trusted me to tell their story. And I told the story about that Armonte Bryant needed a kidney in order to survive.
Wow.
That story, I can tell you that millions of people read that story, or at least clicked on it. And that's, they were the Bryants were overwhelmed with people who were interested in donating or getting tested. I got 50 messages on my own. How do I do this? Happy ending of this is a year later, Armonte Bryant got a kidney right before COVID really hit California. And I was actually supposed to fly out there to write about his recovery process. We ended up having to do it over Zoom like 6 months after, but they are convinced that it was an anonymous donor. I still don't think they know who the donor was. I haven't talked to them in a couple of months, just because life's been a little bit hectic. Those are the types of stories I like telling, because yeah, that was a story about an NFL player and people cared and it got a lot of attention, but it was also a story about organ donation. And it was a story that about a real issue in the United States, because, you know, organ donation is something the waiting lists for people who need organs are much longer than the people willing to donate organs. And I've said this publicly before, so I don't think this is really speaking too out of school. It actually made me decide to be an organ donor. Working on that story, it's one of the most impactful stories I've told in my career. So those are the types of stories I like to tell, the off-field stories. That's what I'm hoping to bring once I'm acclimated in the community and once I'm acclimated with the Falcons, because those are stories that don't happen overnight or with trust. Those are stories that happen with trust. Brandon Copeland, a Falcon, we can talk a little bit about this. I've written a lot about Brandon Copeland, because Brandon Copeland is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. I went with him to his class at UPenn the first year he taught it in 2019. And I actually sat in on one of his classes this year at Penn, because he asked me if I wanted to kind of come and see where it had evolved into. And he actually made me participate, which was really awkward being the 40-year-old sitting there talking to a 21-year-old about budgeting. It was really an interesting conversation. But yeah, I mean, I've written about that. He also worked at a hedge fund, and he's Forbes 30 under 30. Brandon Copeland's a very interesting guy. I like writing stories about interesting people as well. Romeo Okwara, who just signed a big contract with the Lions, I went with him to Rescue 2 in New York, which was a firehouse that lost basically their entire crew that was on shift during 9/11. And he spent about a year there. He started this project when he was with the Giants, and then he got let go and got signed by the Lions, and he followed through on the project. He's a photographer in his downtime, along with a big John Mayer fan, and follows the Grateful Dead around occasionally. Really interesting dude. But he's a big time photographer. And he was working on a project, where he basically was telling the story of this firehouse now, Rescue 2, in their old building. That's an iconic building in their section of Brooklyn. And I went with him for a day to that firehouse and watched him take photos. That photo exhibition ended up being in the Leica store in New York for about 3 to 4 months. Some of his photos were sold. And then it was supposed to, I don't know if it ended up happening or not, but it was supposed to be in Bellevue, Washington at another Leica store. But again, COVID kind of disrupted that, because that was in 2019 into 2020. So those are just some of the stories I've told in the last couple of years that I'm proud of and that I try to tell. I like telling the story that you don't know and that you're not necessarily thinking about, because it's actually generally has very little to do with football and has to do with just all of us being human and having interests. Every person has a story. I'm a firm believer in that. And it's just a matter of finding out what that story is. And some of them are really happy stories and some of them are tragic stories, but I try to find those stories. And that's what I like to tell when I'm not writing about football. And, all that said, I'm going to do my best to give you the best football analysis I can, give you insight that maybe you're not getting elsewhere. And that's what I'm going to try to do. And some days I'm going to do it, hopefully, and do it well. And there are other days where, like you said, this is a competitive beat. And I have all the respect in the world for Jeff and for Tori and for D-Led, and there are going to be days where they beat me, and I know that. And you know, you get, you know, as long as to me, as long as you have that perspective, like, you know, it's, I'm going to do my best every day to tell interesting stories and find stories that hopefully you, the reader, A, find interesting, and B, find valuable, and C, hopefully enjoy and take something from.
Absolutely. Fantastic.
Sorry,
answer.
Didn't mean you to go was, long winded no, again.
No, not at all. You said you said it was a tough question. That was a fantastic answer. So
it was. And this has been super fun.
Oh no, this has been a blast.
Dave, any final thoughts before I take us to our close here?
No, just appreciate you, I can pronounce words, coming on the show. And
it's right, I'm the same way, trust me.
It's just Dave's New England accent.
Yeah, it's wicked appreciated. But yeah, no, just really looking forward to seeing your coverage of the team. And I think it's interesting, like, you're coming in at a time where so much is changing with the Falcons, after so much has been so familiar for so long. So just really, really interested to see how you tackle that, and really looking forward to it.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Dave.
Yeah. So on that note, as we wrap up, Michael, again, thank you so much for joining us. I hope we can get you back on here in the future.
Sure. Anytime
to do it.
Absolutely. Without a doubt.
So if you would let our listeners and our readers know where they can find you, social media, and what you've got going on.
Yeah, sure. So you can find me on way too many social media platforms at Mike Rothstein. That's going to be Twitter. That's going to be Instagram. And although I haven't quite figured out how I want to use it yet, Clubhouse. Then I am at Facebook at Michael Rothstein Journalist. And I think that those are all of my social medias. I may have a TikTok account, but I don't use it. You sign up for everything. Half the time you sign up just to make sure you lock in your name.
Yes.
But I do not use Snapchat. So that covers my social media. And then of course you can read me at ESPN.com. And if you followed me so far, at least on Twitter, hopefully you see as long as it's a respectful conversation, I do my best to engage with fans, and because y'all are the reason that, you know, I'm able to do this job for a living and tell the stories that I was just talking about. And, you know, I get to write about sports and write about people for a living, and it's just an awesome job to have. And I'm very cognizant of the fact that fans are the reason that I get to do that. So feel free to follow me on any of the social media platforms. I'll do my best to engage with you and answer whatever questions you have. And if you ever have a story idea, feel free to reach out there too. Like, sometimes the best story ideas come from fans, and I've had that happen in the past too. I'm not too big to think that. So, like awesome. I said, Mike Rothstein at pretty much any social media platform that you can find me at.
Perfect.
They know I'm not there.
Please go to sbnation.com and read it's our 15th annual team site mock draft. And so you would recognize some names of the authors of the posts there. Eric Robinson from The Falcoholic and Everett Glaze have been helping me out with some posts for other sites even. And so that's really taking up literally all of my time right now. So please read it, make it worth my while. The Falcons got Trey Lance, and so that's how that one shook out for Atlanta.
All right. And of course, on Twitter at Gina Thomas, even though you are now Kelly.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I guess that I was so focused on the mock draft as usual that I completely forgot that part.
That's why I'm here.
Go look at pictures of my dogs. I'm at Gina Thomas.
Dave, as for you, wrap us up here.
Yeah, we're on a little site called The Falcoholic. I'll strum my guitar and tell you about it, but we're definitely going to be hitting the draft hard. You know, we don't know what's going to happen, which is really exciting. I'm sure everybody's sick of hearing me say that we don't know, but we're, you know, a little bit more than a week away from actually figuring this thing out and understanding where the Falcons are going, which is tremendously exciting. So we're going to get our mock drafts wrapped up and everything tied up with a bow. And hopefully you'll join us on draft night. We'll all be there with caffeine and or alcohol in hand.
Lots and lots of alcohol. As for me, guys, you can follow me on Twitter at FalcoholicDW. Updates for this podcast at FalcoholicPod. And of course, our articles daily at thefalcoholic.com. So for Michael Rothstein of ESPN and Gina Kelly and Dave Choate, I almost forgot the names. Oh, it's been a long day. Thanks.
I've been on once and I've destroyed your podcast.
Oh, man. This is David Walker. Thank you guys for listening in, and we will talk with you next time.